last September at the beginning, one Saturday, the core team got together to think and to pray and to go through the upcoming program and all of that kind of stuff. And in the week before that, I was reading from 1 Corinthians. And there were a number of verses that really sort of jumped out at me. Do you want to kick up the first slide? So from 1 Corinthians 1 we had, for it is written, I will destroy the wisdom of the wise, the intelligence of the intelligent I will frustrate. Where is the wise man? Where is the scholar? Where is the philosopher of this age? Has not God made foolish the wisdom of the world? For the foolishness of, and then in verse 25, for the foolishness of God is wiser than man's wisdom. The weakness of God is stronger than man's strength. And then in 1 Corinthians 3, goes on and it says, do not deceive yourselves. If any of you think he is wise by the standards of this age, he should become a fool so that he may become wise. For the wisdom of this world is foolishness in God's sight. As it is written, he catches the wise in their craftiness. And again, the Lord knows the thoughts of the wise are futile. And I don't know about you, but for me, when I hear verses about wisdom, or people talk about wisdom and God's wisdom, it's something that really sort of catches my attention. My ears sort of prick up, and I take notice of it. While I was at New Wine, they had a guy, Rich Mason, there, who did a whole series on Proverbs. He was looking at the wisdom of God, and I found that fascinating, just going through it and looking at it again, and the stuff he had to say on that. And I don't know why that is, but possibly it's because when people prayed for me when I joined core team, one of the words that various number of prayers seemed to talk about was bringing wisdom and that kind of thing. So maybe there's a link there. I'm not saying I'm wise, I don't know if I am. You'll have to ask Sue, you'll have to ask the core team. Certainly last weekend I felt particularly foolish. I managed to put unleaded petrol into Sue's car, which is a diesel. Fortunately, I only put 8-9 litres in, and the advice I got was that if I brimmed it with diesel, I'd probably get away with it, and so far I have. So we're keeping our fingers... No, we're hoping that'll carry on. So it was great that we didn't have to have the tank drained and all of that kind of stuff. But for the sort of 2 hours... I discussed it with various people. I did feel particularly foolish having done that. But the whole thing with God's wisdom, wisdom of the world, is something that I find is a real tension, particularly with the job that I do. Working for Dayspring, I believe I bring certain skills, abilities, and I believe those are God-given. I obviously have an experience for my life, and again, that applies to my job, and I'm able to apply that. But all of that, I feel, is, I don't know whether taint is the word, but certainly there is an element of worldly wisdom within that. And so, in a given situation, I will have a reaction or a thought of ways forward, what I should do, how I should react to it. But is it always God's wisdom? Is it always God's way? A couple of weeks ago, Marion, Dave and myself had got together. We were going through the upcoming program and events that Dayspring have got on. A meeting that we have on a regular basis just to tie things together and make sure things are up together. And Dave brought up Cabaret Connection. He said, well, Cabaret Connection is routine now. And my thought was, yes, it is routine and I can understand that, but it must never become routine. You know, we know the venue, we've organised the acts, we've got excellent team of people who've been willing to give up their afternoon and their evening to do all the myriad of jobs that we need done for Cabaret. But if we only go through the motions with it, I think we will miss something. But it really, I always want, in my heart with Cabaret, is to put on the best thing I can for God and to serve those guests that come so that they feel the love of God and they hear the story of faith. And I believe always with putting it on, I have to be open to the input of God. But He may take it in a different direction or put a different emphasis on it or want to shake the whole thing up. At the end of the day, Cabaret is His. It's not something I do or Dayspring does or people put it on. It's for Him to do. So there is sort of that tension, and while I'm applying those skills and abilities to Cabaret to make it as best I can make it, I want to hear from God and get His input as well. Another example, about a year and a half ago, we were putting together the half-year financial results for Dayspring. I think that giving was a little bit behind the year before. that we were spending a bit more money than we were getting in. But we were coping, we were managing, we were watching the cash flow very closely, and I quite enjoy that, seeing the money come in, working what bills I can pay, remembering what cheques I've written, making sure I don't go overdrawn, or the account doesn't go overdrawn. There's a bit of fun I find in that, that's just the way I am. it's nice when you get it right, it's a pain when you get it wrong. But I was writing the commentary for Core Team, and I actually started typing that into the email, you know, by watching the cash flow, we're managing, we're coping. I thought, no, that's wrong. We believe in a God who has infinite resource, believe in a God who loves to bless us and to give us that. And while he may not put £1 million in Dayspring's account, which would last us for 10 years, because we'd likely after 5 forget who'd given us the money, I do believe that he's able to give us more than enough to run the church and do the events and pay the salary. And it shouldn't be about coping and managing. I think that's sort of the world's way of looking at it. We should be looking to God to provide. And I shared some of that at Core Team, and I know at times we've asked you guys to do it as well. I've been praying and seeking God about the finances, and to be fair, since then it's got easier. I don't look at the cash flow quite as often as I used to. And it's something I might look at once a week. And at times I just pay the bills because I know I've got the money and we just get on with it. And so I really do believe. So again, there's that tension that I find in the job that I do and wanting to do that. During the autumn we looked at discipleship. Remember the cross with all the different shoes on it. And we talked about different aspects of discipleship. And because of that and because of some stuff that Andy and Dave and I were discussing, I actually reflected on my life and God's part in that. And I shared some of that in one of the talks. I talked about how I was working in Germany and I decided that it was time to come back to the UK, that God wanted me to come back to the UK. I had an offer for a job in Germany that was using my skills to do something I was comfortable with. It would involve an increase in salary. But I felt it was right to come back to the UK to a job that I almost had to start from scratch, but it wasn't something I felt I had all the skills and the abilities to do. And certainly there was also a salary cut in there. There was an additional advantage because Sue and I had started going out, so I was coming a little bit closer to her geographically, and obviously had an advantage. And I shared how God honoured me in that decision. I believe he did, in that before I started the job I'd been moved to another job which involved a bit of a salary increase, and it more used the skills and the abilities I had. And I guess I think it was a year and a half into that job, I've sat around the canteen table at work, and I don't know how it came up in conversation, but I was able actually to share what I'd done and the decision I'd made coming back from Germany. And there were a number of people sat around that table that couldn't understand why I decided to do that. Why wouldn't you take the job in Germany that was more money? Why wouldn't you do that? Is what they said. And yet I really do believe that was God speaking, God's wisdom, following that. And while it looks silly to the world, it's something I don't regret. We used to have a saying in Avon, hindsight is 20/20. It's great looking back on things when they've gone wrong because you can see all the points and point out what people should have done or shouldn't have done. But I look back on those decisions and I don't regret them. And obviously Sue and I decided to get married. We got married, we settled in Wiltshire, became part of Dayspring, and it was about a year into being part of Dayspring I really began to see that I had a heart for Wiltshire, a calling to Wiltshire, and the mission and the vision that Dayspring had was something that I really felt too. And I started talking to Dave about working full Dayspring full time, and it took 8 years to get to that point. And there were some points where opportunities came up within Dayspring. I thought maybe this is it. Maybe it wasn't. I guess every other year, certainly if not every year, I had people ringing me up offering me jobs elsewhere in the country. Generally, it was an easy thing to answer. I was able to say, "Is it in Wiltshire? No, it's not. Okay, I'm not interested." But I had those offers and things going on. And then Dave came to a point where Dave said, "I think now's the time." And Sue and I started praying about it. Is this finally it? We'd had other points where we'd been praying. And I was really grateful that we both had a huge sense of truth about it. We really believed that God was in this. It was the time for me to give up my job with Avon and start working for Dayspring. And while we believed that God would be with us, that he would bless us, that he would look after us, that he would keep us, so my practical mind was thinking, well, cut and pay, it might mean, I don't know, might mean we can't run two cars. Can I cope with that? Yeah, I think I can. Might mean that our holidays are just going down to Devon to Sue's parents' cottage every year, or doing holidays in tents in the UK or whatever. Can I cope with that? Yeah, I guess I can. And while to you maybe, you know, you may not have a car, you may only have one car, running a second car may not be a big thing. Dave shared how a good holiday each year is more important to him than a new sofa in his front room. And I know for other people, holidays don't really interest you, it's not a big priority. But I'm sure if we chatted and we unpicked things, we could find things that if I said, no, you can't have that anymore, you'd be not sure I can cope with that. But I have to say that God has blessed us. The money has come in, we still are running two cars, and it is hugely helpful. On a Sunday morning, I'm able to come early, and the kids can come later, we'll see. Although one of the two of them come with me. And you know, it's things like that, and you think there ought to be, well, there would be ways around it, but it would just be more difficult. And each year, for whatever reason, we've managed to find the money to take a holiday abroad. And Sue and I just love her holidays abroad, the weather's nicer. I like going to other countries and seeing how they live, eating the food. It's great just walking, you know, we were in Turkey and we were able to walk around and show the kids banana plants and bananas growing on them and that kind of thing. Things I grew up with, and being able to show them that and be able to talk to them and see it real and that kind of thing. And I really believe God has blessed us and he does that. Money may not drop through mysteriously through the letterbox, but we do see money come in that we wouldn't expect, and it allows us, and God is looking after us. So within that whole discipleship thing, again, there is sort of my mindset, what I was thinking, and there's what God has done in his wisdom. At the beginning of December, Dave sent Andy and I, maybe the rest of the court, I don't know, but he sent an email. It was a collection of blogs from a guy called Martin Scott. Martin Scott has been very influential in the whole pioneer network of churches that we're part of. He's a guy with a real prophetic gift from God. And certainly sort of late 90s, early 2000s, he was talking about revival and the fact it was around the corner and it was going to happen, and really, really excited about that. And part of his blog, he was actually having to answer the question, so revival hasn't happened, do you still believe it will? And the bit that jumped out at me, he actually wrote, he said, yes, I do believe in revival, but my perspective is that we need to see the church weakened yet further if we are to see something restored that is authentic. There is a wrong weddedness to power that has to be broken. My mind when I read that was drawn back to, I don't know, 6-7 years ago. I was on the town, Christmas time, we were giving away mince pies and mulled wine, and this guy came up and he took the hot drink and he took the mince pie. He asked what it was about. I said, oh, we're the local churches, just trying to give away, you know, some things free, show you the love of God, wish you the best for Christmas. And he said, oh, that's good. He said, Salvation Army were all also on the street and they were playing carols and things. And he said, got all the respect in the world for the Salvation Army. I actually give money to them, but I've got no respect for the church. And I said to him, why is that? And he said, well, Salvation Army do what you preach I should do in the church. And he made the point that the churches, in his experience, all about grabbing money and building new steeples and putting new roofs on buildings. The Salvation Army were out there helping the poor, the homeless, the hungry, and that kind of thing. And Andy and I and Dave were fortunate enough to be chatting to Carl Wills a week ago, I guess it was. And Carl again said he felt that the last 10 years the church had gained an authenticity and a respect with the fact that they're out on the streets. You know, a lot of churches are out there offering healing to people. It isn't about coming into the building to a healing meeting, actually getting out where the need is, churches like ours are out there giving things away for free, and we're beginning to gain an authenticity then. And I was also drawn to the fact that when Jesus came, the whole of the Jewish nation were looking for a Messiah, but most of them were looking for somebody who would overthrow the Roman Empire, who would set up the nation of Israel again, and would create something physical on this earth. You know, and it was about them being God's people, God's special people, them having their special place. And yes, they wanted the nation to be living and ruled by God's laws. They would expect, if people came to visit Israel and were trading with Israel, that when they were in Israel they would feel the presence of God and feel something from God in that. But God had a much bigger plan with Jesus. His plan was to reach the world, to reach us. And it wasn't something physical. I mean, no, looking at Israel's history 500 years on from that, they'd have probably turned away, forgotten who God was, and been back where they were. And God was looking to do something different with Jesus. And because of his death and what he did, we're able to have a relationship with him, and we're here today. And so you had a very sort of world wisdom view of what the Messiah should be, and yet you had God's wisdom and his plan for not only for his people, the Jews, but for everyone, because he loves everyone. And so again, there's, you know, Martin Scott goes on to say, he said often recent revivals have been about, they've been good because they've changed society and they've changed things happening in society, but they've been about empowering the people who are converted over the people who are not. And I've been in those prayer meetings where, you know, we've all prayed, and I've prayed the prayers where it's about, Lord, give the power back to your church, give the influence to your church, bring the people into your church, bring revival. And it's all about what's happening within our building, our boundaries, our influence. And maybe God's revival is going to be something bigger than that, something that touches everyone in this nation and touches them whether they believe and know him or whether they don't. And then the final thing that really hit me was, I don't know if you, some of you were at Christmas Connections, you've heard this story, Simon was interviewed, and he finished up with a story about the battle for Goose Green in the Falklands War. Now, I don't know if you remember that, you probably remember the name Goose Green, I certainly do, and you probably remember a guy called Colonel H. Jones who was killed in that battle, and I can actually remember it coming over on the news when it was announced. But the interesting story is, in that battle, started fighting, I think it was the first land offensive in the war, is that right?
Yeah, it was the first major battle.
Yeah, major battle. First day they'd lost, the person leading it, Colonel H. Jones, they'd had many of the, or most of the objectives that they'd been hoping to reach on that first day had not been reached. And they were at a point, the people leading that, we're discussing, what do we do, where do we go? And Colonel Jones's second in command happened to be a Christian, and he took time to step out of the command post and spend some time praying and saying, Lord, what do we do? And he felt God said to him, he said, go and ask the Argentinians to surrender. So he came back in and he said, right guys, we're going to ask the Argentinians to surrender. And they all looked at him and said, you what? And Simon shared, it is now part of, I think, the Sandhurst training, but it's certainly within no manual or training up to then. You know, you're in effect not gaining in a battle, and yet you ask the opponents to surrender. Still, they found an Argentinian prisoner of war, sent him back across the lines with an offer that the Argentinians should surrender, and they did. And I think, Simon, you said that more Argentinians came out when there were British troops fighting them, and significantly more as well, I think you said.
Yeah,
so, you know, world's wisdom, no way will they surrender. God's wisdom, ask and see. And so that's sort of where I am, this whole tension between the world's wisdom, God's wisdom. And it's something, you know, initially when I saw the passage, I thought it was for the core team, get to the end of the day together. But it keeps popping up and it's something I... So anyway, I'm going to talk a little bit about it, or where we are. So what I thought we'd do is maybe we could look at the life of Daniel, as somebody who was wise, who obviously followed God and God's wisdom. Daniel was born as a Jew. He was born to a noble family, or even part of the royal family. And when he was a teenager, the superpower of the day, the Babylonians, lay siege to Jerusalem, and they defeated Jerusalem, and they took Daniel and everyone who was living in Jerusalem back to Babylon as captives, as exiles. And King Nebuchadnezzar, who was the king of the Babylonians, was obviously quite a clever guy. He decided the best way to assimilate the Jews into Babylonian society was actually to take the teenagers and give them the best of Babylonian education and so on, and actually make them part of the civil service and part of the society. So Daniel and his three friends, Meshach, Shadrach and Abednego, were chosen to be part of this. They were dressed in the Babylonian way. They were given the best education that they could be offered in those days from the Babylonian people. And of course, many of you remember that they were offered food from the king's table, and they decided they wouldn't take that. They didn't want to be defiled by it. And so a couple of verses to me in Daniel 1 jump out. You've got the fact that God calls the official who was looking after him to show favour and sympathy to Daniel. So Daniel went to him and said, "I don't want to eat the king's best food, I don't want to drink his wine, just give us vegetables, just give us water, that's all we want to eat." The official was nervous. He said, "Well, you look less healthy than the other ones. The king will think I've been shortchanging you from his provisions. He might have my head." And Daniel said, "Well, okay, give us 10 days, test us, see what happens." And so 10 days time, he and Shadrach, Meshach and Abednego looked far more healthy than the others, and so they were allowed to eat vegetables and water. And then later on in the verse, you get in chapter 17, you get, "To these four young men Daniel gave knowledge and to these four young men God gave knowledge and understanding of all kinds of literature and learning, and Daniel could understand visions and dreams of all kinds." And so you might say, "Well, I'm not wise, I'm not clever, I haven't had the opportunities you've had, Dave, with your education and things." But it isn't about you, it's about God. He gives the wisdom. And in James 1:5 it actually says, "If any of you lacks wisdom, then ask God." And you see here, even with Daniel, who was someone who, if you read the whole of the book of Daniel, incredibly wise person, and yet he came from God, and he knew that. The other thing interesting, we focus on the fact he said no to the food, but he also said yes to several things. He said yes to the education, he said yes to wearing the clothes, as far as we know, and he said yes to becoming part of Babylonian society, to becoming an advisor to King Nebuchadnezzar. When I was a teenager, and apparently the Soviet Union was on the borders of Western Europe and about to invade and take it all over, I did sometimes think that if they did invade England and take over, I would join the resistance and fight against it. I guess I had romantic notions of the French resistance, and I'd probably have been too scared, and I wouldn't have been any good at it, and would have probably ended up dead. But, you know, I'm sure Daniel, as a teenager, hot-headed, would have had some of those. You know, we're going to rebel, we're going to fight against this, this is wrong, this isn't what God wants. And yet, he obviously heard from God that he should go forward with this. And he heard about the food and he decided that's where he'd make a stand. But it wasn't about the education or the food. And then at the end of chapter 1, Nebuchadnezzar actually sits down with this group of people who've had this training for a year, and he starts chatting to them. And he actually says he found Daniel, Shadrach, Meshach and Abednego 10 times more learned, 10 times wiser than the others. And so God really blessed them with the wisdom there. But then in Daniel 2, Nebuchadnezzar has a dream. He's quite a clever king, because he realises A, it's an important dream, and B, if he wants to know the true meaning of it, he shouldn't tell anyone the dream, he should let them tell him the dream, and then he'll know that they're able to tell him the interpretation of it. And all the wise men say, "Oh, that's not the way it's done. Can't possibly ask us to do that." And he threatens to cut all the heads off. So Daniel actually goes to him and says, "Look, give me a bit of time. I think we might be able to do something." And that night, well, Daniel and his three friends sit down and pray about it. That night, Daniel has the dream, and he's able to go to King Nebuchadnezzar and say, "Look, I know what the dream is, and I'll tell you the interpretation." And the king actually says, the king actually says, "So you know, you're able to interpret this." And Daniel doesn't forget where it came from, because he actually says to the king, "No wise man, enchanter, magician, or diviner can explain to the king the mystery he has asked about. For there is a God in heaven who reveals mysteries. He has shown King Nebuchadnezzar what will happen in the days to come." And so there's two things there. Daniel is not forgetting where the source of his wisdom, his power comes from. Also, it's quite a clever thing to say, because Nebuchadnezzar could quite easily say, "Well, Daniel's obviously the man, the rest of you wise men are no good, I'll just chop your heads off anyway." And so by saying, "No wise man, you know, what you asked really was unfair, Nebuchadnezzar." But anyway, he then tells him the dream, he tells him the answer. And you notice that in verse 47, King Nebuchadnezzar says, "Surely your God is the God of gods, and the Lord of kings, and the revealer of mysteries, for you are able to reveal this mystery." So Nebuchadnezzar's actually moved on a step. He knows Daniel's clever, he said he's 10 times cleverer than all the others, or wise, 10 times wiser. He's now beginning to understand what it is, the source of Daniel's wisdom, what's behind it. And so he's beginning to acknowledge that there is a God, and he knows that. Then in Daniel 3, it doesn't actually involve Daniel, but it does involve his three friends, Shadrach, Meshach and Abednego, the famous fiery furnace, which some of you may remember from your days in Sunday school. I know we've done a lot when I was in Sunday school. King Nebuchadnezzar sets up this huge golden image and says everyone must worship it. Shadrach, Meshach and Abednego say, "No, we're not going to." He says, "Well, I'm going to give you one last chance. You will worship it, or you're going in the fiery furnace." And they say this wonderful line. They say, "The God we serve is able to save us, but even if he doesn't, we're not going to bow down and serve your image." So again, they realised where they were rooted, what the foundation of their life was, and they were willing to stand up for it and trust God. Nebuchadnezzar obviously loses his rag at that point. Has the furnace heated up to a temperature that those throwing Shadrach, Meshach and Abednego in the furnace actually die because it's so hot. And so they get thrown in there. And a bit later he looks in the furnace and says, "I thought we only threw 3 people in there." They said, "Well, you did." He said, "Oh, there was a 4th. So he calls them out, and he actually says in the Bible, it says, "Not a hair on their head, he's singed." And then Nebuchadnezzar says this, he says, "Praise be to the God of Shadrach, Meshach and Abednego, who sent his angel and rescued his servants. They trusted in him and defied the king's command, and were willing to give up their lives rather than serve or worship any god except their own God." And so again, you see Nebuchadnezzar's moved on another step. He's not only acknowledged God, he's beginning to praise him. Then in Daniel 4, I didn't get a picture for this one, so I'll put up with the text. Daniel 4 is an interesting passage. Nebuchadnezzar has another dream. He asks Daniel about it. Daniel is fairly troubled because he says, "I wish this dream was something your enemies have had." It's something about Nebuchadnezzar. Nebuchadnezzar is quite a proud bloke. He's obviously ruler of one of the superpowers of the then known world. And God's basically saying, "I'm going to humble you." And for a year Nebuchadnezzar manages to keep his pride in check, and then he walks out and he sees Babylonia sort of before him, and he says, "Wow, didn't I do a good job?" And God says, "Right." And I don't don't know, it's fully clear in the passage, but it appears Nebuchadnezzar lost his sanity. He was driven away from the community. He lived in the field. It talks about him having the dew falling on him, talks about him eating grass and all of that kind of stuff. And yet, at the end, it says, at the end of that time, I, Nebuchadnezzar, raised my eyes toward heaven, and my sanity was restored. Then I praised the Most High. I honoured and glorified him who lives forever. And you've got him doing that. And then in verse 37, I am now I, Nebuchadnezzar, praise and exalt and glorify the King of heaven, because everything he does is right, and all his ways are just. And those who walk in pride, he is able to humble. So Nebuchadnezzar actually is there praising God. He knows who God is. Possibly, quite probably, he's got a relationship with God. And he's aware of all of that. And so, you know, when Daniel was first taken from Jerusalem to Babylon, and he was given this offer to become part of, to be educated and become part of the society, become part of the civil service, be raised up as an advisor. I wonder if he thought, you know, down the line, this king, this ruler of this superpower is actually going to become someone who knows and praises God. Or was he thinking, well, really what I'd like to do is get the nation of Israel back and go and live in Jerusalem? I don't know. But again, that's God's wisdom. And Daniel followed it. And then in chapter 5, yep. I'm sorry, this picture hadn't come out very well. There is a hand writing on the wall, finger writing on the wall, rather. Mm-hmm. Remember that Nebuchadnezzar has passed on, his son has become king, and his son has become king. He decides he's going to do things his own way, and one of the first things he does is organise this huge banquet for all his officials and his wives and his concubines and all of that kind of stuff. And as part of the banquet, they go and get the stuff that had been taken from the temple in Jerusalem, and they start with the bowls and the plates and things, and they start drinking from it and eating off it and things. And in the middle of this hand appears high up on the wall and writes some writing on the wall. And they're all terrified. You can see there's people there fairly terrified. Invisible hand, as it shows. They're all terrified. None of his advisors can tell him what it means. And it's not until probably his queen mother, although again, it's not totally clear, actually says, in your father's time, in Nebuchadnezzar's time, there was an advisor called Daniel. He knew the Most High God, and he will be able to explain this to you. So this king gets hold of Daniel and asks him about it. And Daniel basically says, you knew about Nebuchadnezzar, you ignored what happened to him, you've been weighed, you've been found wanting, and your kingdom will be taken from you. And so you've got Daniel there, he's been a bit sidelined. He's obviously not in the inner circle, he's got a new king, he's deciding to go his own way, and yet he's still needed and he still gives that. And that night, the Medes and Persians and King Darius besiege Babylon, and it falls, and Darius becomes the new king, and that is the new superpower. And when you that shows a change in power. And then we know from chapter 6 in Daniel that Daniel becomes the chief advisor to King Darius. And so when you think about it, like when the USA invaded Iraq, they plucked a teenager from Iraq, put him through Harvard, put him through Yale, gave him the best education in the US possible, and within no time he's a chief advisor within the White House. Over and above that, the American president, whoever he is, actually takes the religion of that advisor as his own. Now, I know that with, you know, Daniel knew God, and so therefore it's bringing Nebuchadnezzar to something that was real, but there was that amount of movement. And then whoever takes over the USA, and they take this chief advisor from the White House and make him their chief advisor. That's what Daniel did. And it seems impossible today, and I think it probably is, but with God's power, God's wisdom, it was. So Daniel becomes chief advisor to King Darius. The other advisors are a bit put out by this and decide they want to get rid of him, and they find the only way they can do this is if they do something that's to do with his God. Don't you say that? He wants to serve his God more than he wants to please man. And so they come up with what seems a fairly cunning plan. They trick the king into making a law that people can only pray to the king for 30 days. And that's put in. Daniel knows about it. Daniel's in the habit of praying 3 times a day at an open window. And he continues to do that. I wonder if I'd have found somewhere a bit more private to carry on. When my parents were in Brazil during the 1970 World Cup, which was actually in Mexico, but Brazil were obviously fanatical about it because they went on to win it. And one of the missionaries that they were there, an English person, was a keen football supporter. Either just before the World Cup or a year later, England actually came to play Brazil in Rio. And he went to the Maracanã Stadium to watch the game, and he was there waving the Union Jack. And the Brazilians around him, sort of a little way into the game, said, "Do you mind putting the Union Jack away?" And the Brazilian supporters at the other side of the stadium were trying to pelt this person waving the Union Jack. They weren't very good shots, so they were hitting all the people who stood around. So he put it down to stop them being hit by eggs, tomatoes, whatever. Been crazy. But my mum used the phrase, she said, during the World Cup, she said, "In a window without rooms, we waved our flag and listened to the world service as England played in the World Cup." And I thought, if I'd been Daniel, I think I might have found a room without windows to pray in. But he carried on praying at open window, and they saw him. Told the king. The king realised he'd been tricked, but there was nothing he could do. The laws of the Medes and Persians had to be enacted. So Daniel was thrown into the lion's den. He was left there overnight. He was taken out of the. The next morning, the king rushed along to see if he'd survived, and he actually had. So he was hauled out, and the advisors and the wives and the children who had tricked the king were thrown in instead. And the lions. Well, they almost ate them before they hit the floor, as it's described, and crushed their bones. So, again, you've got someone who is able, with a change of king, still rise to be a key advisor, but he knew where the source of his wisdom was from, and he stayed plugged into that. As a kid, I used to love Bible quizzes. I used to be quite good at them. And I think if I'd been asked who was the wisest person in the Bible, I'd have actually said Solomon. And you remember Solomon became king of Israel, succeeded David. He would, God visited him in a dream and said, "I'll give you anything you want. What do you want?" And he actually said, "Give me wisdom so I can rule Israel wisely and justly." God was so pleased with that answer, he not only made him the wisest person that's probably ever walked on the earth, he also gave him gold and jewels and all sorts of riches and things as well. And if you read the chapters, you'll see Solomon built the temple and it was magnificent, and he built his palace and it was magnificent, and Queen of Sheba came to visit him and she'd heard reports, and she asked him all sorts of questions, and he was able to answer because he was so wise. And he showed her around the kingdom and explained how he ruled it and showed her the magnificence of the place. And she actually says at the end, she says, "I heard reports, but they only told half the story. Your wisdom is better than anyone's told me. The riches are more magnificent. The way you rule the country is so just. People must rejoice." And she goes on to say that it all comes from God. So there was Solomon, we were plugged into God, real wisdom. And yet, 2 or 3 chapters later, in the Book of Kings. God is actually saying to Solomon, you've turned away from me, you've hardened your heart towards me, I'm going to take the kingdom away from your son. And at that point the kingdom of Israel divided into the 10 tribes and the 2 tribes. And it was only because of the sake of David that Solomon's son actually was king of those smaller kingdom of Judah. And so, you know, in one sense Solomon was wiser than Daniel, but in another sense he lost where the source was and forgot that he turned his back on God and ended his life looking a bit foolish, I guess, having lost the kingdom. So I guess that's really all I had to say. I mean, really, I think, you know, Dave's been talking about saying, here I am, wholly available. And I think if we truly say that, we've got to be open to God asking us to do things that through our eyes, through our experience, would look not clever things to do, or not the best thing to do. And I'd really encourage you in all situations to be actually looking for God's wisdom. Difficult issues at work, problems with the family at home, wondering whether you should change jobs, different job, new, change life, whatever. Really should be looking to God for wisdom. As I said, it says in James 1:5, if you don't feel wise and you lack wisdom, then ask God. And be ready for him to answer and to maybe give you a new perspective on things or a new insight to things. And then I guess the other thing is a real challenge for all of us is to remember the source of that wisdom and to stay plugged into it, as Daniel did, and to be ready. And there you had someone who was living in a society that was ungodly, and yet he had a huge effect and influence on that society and brought glory to God in what he did through it. And in the same way, we, in our own situations, I believe we can do that as well. So I think that's all I really had to say. So thank you very much. It's 2 minutes early, so that's good.